Eid al-Fitr marks the end of the Muslim fasting month of Ramadan, with people in Iran and other countries performing special congregational prayers to celebrate the occasion. Russian President Vladimir Putin signs a decree to impose tit-for-tat sanctions on unfriendly states and entities. Also ahead, Boris Johnson admits the UK government is not doing enough to ease struggling families amid a record high inflation. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Muslims in several countries are celebrating Eid al-Fitr, a major Islamic feast that marks the end of the holy month of Ramadan. Iranians have marked the auspicious occasion with worshippers attending Eid al-Fitr prayers nationwide. Iraq, India, and Pakistan have also commemorated the event. Other Muslim nations observe the Eid on Sunday and Monday. The timing of the occasion can differ in various countries. That depends on the sighting of the new moon, which marks the beginning of the month of Shawwal on the lunar calendar. Eid al-Fitr is an official holiday in all Muslim countries.
The fasting month of Ramadan is over, and Muslims have ushered in the second most important festivity in Islam, Eid al-Fitr, or the Festival of Breakfast. Muslims start their Eid al-Fitr by taking part in congregational prayers themed with bidding farewell to Ramadan and welcoming the Eid.
Eid al-Fitr is a celebration of our months-long endeavor to connect with God more closely than other times of the year by enduring the hardship of fasting. I'm so happy to be able to fast, and Eid al-Fitr is my reward.
I am so happy to mark Eid al-Fitr, but at the same time I miss the spiritual atmosphere of Ramadan. It's a month when you feel closer to God than ever.
After they complete the Eid al-Fitr prayer, Muslims then visit their relatives and loved ones during the festivity. It's the first time in 2 years that Muslims have marked Eid al-Fitr without COVID curbs, so they can celebrate Eid al-Fitr together.
Over the past 2 years, we were not able to visit the elderly and other relatives. Thanks God, the coronavirus has subsided and we can celebrate Eid al-Fitr with the people we love.
Every year on Eid al-Fitr, Muslims set aside a portion of their annual income, dhabt fitriya, to donate it to the poor. They say this is to spread the happy mood of Eid al-Fitr among the needy.
Zakat al-Fitr is a very small portion of our income, but it makes a significant difference when all affording Muslims join in. This way, the rich and the poor share the festive mood of Eid al-Fitr.
Eid al-Fitr falls on the first day of the lunar month of Shawwal. According to the Islamic lunar calendar, months begin and end depending on the movement of the moon in its orbit around the earth. And the start of each month depends on the sighting of the new moon the day before. Iran sighted the Eid al-Fitr crescent on the eve of Tuesday, while many other Muslim nations announced the festivity on Sunday and Monday.
Eid al-Fitr is a culmination of 1 month of abstinence from eating and drinking. And that's why Muslims consider it a divine reward for their success in obeying God's order. This year, the festive mood is multiplied as Muslims can celebrate it together without the worries of the pandemic. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Russian President Vladimir Putin issues a new decree imposing retaliatory economic sanctions against, quote, unfriendly countries and entities. The Kremlin says the move is in response to anti-Russian measures taken by some countries and international organizations. Russia will prohibit the export of products and raw materials to people and entities under sanctions. The order also bans transactions with individuals and companies from certain countries and asks Russian counterparties not to fulfill their obligations towards them. The Russian government has 10 days to compile a list of foreign individuals and companies to be blacklisted. The U.S., the EU, and some other allies have imposed a wave of sanctions on Moscow since it launched a war on Ukraine in late February. Journalist and political commentator Fred Weir joined us with his take on Russia's retaliatory sanctions against Western countries.
I think the Russian idea will be to find some selected targets where it can make its point. The trick in is to hurt the target and not have it blow back on yourself. And one of the things we're learning from all these Western sanctions right now is that there's a tremendous amount of self-inflicted collateral damage in the West, even though they're also hurting Russia. An example of a clever way to do it was the Russians in 2015. They announced a whole series of counter-sanctions against the European Union, which was sanctioning them in finance and industry and so on. They banned European food products from Russia, from being imported into Russia. And that hurt European countries who had been major exporters, and it stimulated Russian agriculture so that by this time, like it's only 7-8 years later, Russian agriculture is practically self-sufficient.
The British Prime Minister says his government cannot provide enough financial support to ease the pain of the current cost of living in the country for the months ahead.
Because I accept that those contributions from the taxpayer, because that's what it is, taxpayers' money, isn't going to be enough immediately to help cover everybody's costs. Of course that isn't going to work in enough in the short term.
So you acknowledge you are not doing everything
there
you
is,
can.
There is more that we can do.
Yes.
But the crucial thing is to make sure we deal with the prices over the medium and long term. Although you're quite right to point out that there is an inflationary risk and it's very severe, it could get worse. And that knocks onto interest rates and that knocks onto the cost of borrowing for everybody. And I'm sorry to say this, but we have to be prudent in our approach. We're not saying...
Johnson rejected the prospect of raising welfare benefits in line with inflation. He argued that such a measure can potentially drive inflation even higher. The prime minister also rebuffed the idea of a windfall tax on oil and gas giants, saying the move would discourage energy companies from making investments. Britain is grappling with soaring inflation, which hit a 30-year high of 7% in March. That, coupled with the war in Ukraine, that is taking a toll on the British economy. Surging prices are contributing to the biggest squeeze on household incomes since at least the 1950s. Retail sales and consumer confidence have fallen significantly in the past months. For more on that, we're joined by our correspondent in London, Amina Taylor. Amina, what is the significance of the Prime Minister admitting that there is more his government can do, but is not, to ease the situation for many British households who have difficulty paying their bills, especially energy bills?
The Prime Minister tried to turn it around and say, well, any increases in line with the rate of inflation to offset some of these issues, especially when it comes to welfare payments, would actually be counterproductive. Well, let's examine that a little bit more, because you're talking about a Prime Minister who on the same day is saying that there is no space or scope for a windfall tax, is not acknowledging that one of the largest energy suppliers in the United Kingdom, BP, posted record profits today. Profits for the first quarter of this year, 6.2 billion compared to 2.6 billion over the same period last year. So obviously, there is money being made somewhere in the economy. You talk about the Prime Minister who said he will not be putting up welfare benefits. Well, this is the same person who's heading the same government that took away £20 per week from universal credit stats, and also had his chancellor increase national insurance contributions. So you put that with the other issues that householders have to face, and well, here is a man who is out of touch. You're talking about a government that clearly is not matching its words with some of its deeds. If it cared about the consumer, if it cared about the most vulnerable, I think a windfall tax would have been a no-brainer. Who would have objected to that? A few people making billions out of this economy, out of this crisis. I don't see any other way around that conversation, unfortunately.
So, Amina, tell us more about the opposition party's criticism of the government for refusing to increase taxes on oil and gas companies.
Well, they're saying the prime minister doesn't have a strategy for getting Brits out of this squeeze. And they're right to an extent. I think they know what needs to be done in terms of the government's own reactions here. But here's the problem. People are not yet ready to trust the Labour vision with providing any necessary recourse or recompense here. Keir Starmer has talked a good game, but so far his policies, by and large, with the exception of that windfall tax, seem to be mirroring those of the Conservatives quite closely. So is there actually a big difference and a massive choice for voters come Thursday? We will argue when it comes to what's going on in Ukraine, what's going on in terms of the cost of living crisis, and the way in which we're going to tackle some of the ills of British society here. It's very hard for supporters and voters to differentiate between the Labour position on this issue and the Conservative position on this issue. So with a very small difference there, with Labour supporting a windfall tax and the Conservatives not willing to do so, I think most voters are just thinking, these guys are pretty much the same, and whoever, in terms of the major two parties, would take over, we'd still be left in the same crisis. A radical solution is needed, and none of the two major parties seem to be providing that.
Oh, thank you very much. Our correspondent, Amina Taylor, live from London. The Iranian foreign minister says negotiations to restore the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA have not stopped and are continuing in a different format. In an interview, Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Iran and the U.S. are exchanging written messages through the EU representative to the Vienna talks. He said the process is aimed at the removal of unilateral U.S. sanctions. The talks began in April last year, but with only a few issues remaining to be settled, the negotiators left the Austrian capital several weeks ago and have since not returned. Amir Abdullahian added that Iran seeks a robust and durable deal and has asked the Americans to be realistic. The top diplomat said the U.S. is fully aware of Iran's red lines and has been notified that the removal of all sanctions and the provisions of economic guarantees are among Tehran's key demands. A family of an Iranian national on trial in Sweden for alleged rights abuses, Hossein Hamid Nouri, a retired employee of the Iranian judiciary, was humiliated, beaten, and denied access to medical services. Swedish prosecutors have requested life imprisonment for Nouri over alleged human rights violations against members of the anti-Iran terror group Mujahideen Khalq organization back in the 1980s. Videos on social media show MKO members harassing Nouri's family as they enter a court building. The footage shows that Swedish police failed to protect the family. Meanwhile, Nouri's wife laments that Swedish officials did not allow them to even meet him for nearly 2 years after his arrest. On Sunday, Iran's foreign ministry summoned the Swedish ambassador to protest the detention and trial of Nouri. The ministry said it considers Nouri's detention illegal and based on propaganda by the anti-Iran terror group MKO. The ministry rejected allegations against Nouri as baseless and described his trial as a political show. The MKO is responsible for killing some 12,000 Iranian people and officials in the 1980s, including the country's then president and prime minister. Meanwhile, another instance of the Holy Quran's burning has erupted in Sweden as a notorious racist activist from Denmark continues his Quran burning tour of Sweden. Fears are high of a return to the 4 days of violence which saw furious Muslims vent their anger at authorities over the Easter weekend burnings. Robert Carter is in Stockholm and has this latest report.
Quran burnings have once again returned to Sweden as far-right Danish activist Rasmus Paludan desecrated the holy book outside Stockholm's central masjid on Sunday. Later that same day, he travelled to Uppsala and attempted to burn another, but local Muslims chase him off, one nearly being run over in the process. Paludan is a notorious leader of a far-right political party which stood in the last Danish elections, receiving just 1.8% of the vote, failing to win a seat. In 2020, he was jailed for racism and other offences. Throughout the month of Ramadan, Paludan has toured Sweden, burning Qurans in several Muslim-majority areas in various cities, sparking 4 days of violent unrest over the Easter weekend. Local Swedish opposition Nuance Party condemned the authorities for allowing the burnings.
Well, actually, in Sweden, you're not allowed to say or do whatever you want. So this concept of freedom of speech is already has its rules and its regulations. For example, 3 years ago, a neo-Nazi party burnt the Pride flag, the flag that the LGBT movement uses. And for that, they were charged for hate speech or hate against a certain people. Nowadays, the politicians, they don't account Muslims into these kind of minorities. On one hand, they are defending other minorities and their rights to be left alone or to not be hated against. And on the other hand, they are defending people who are hating it towards or against Muslims.
There's no word to describe our disappointment to the other political parties and the public figures that are defending him. We don't see any political parties that are going out and defending the Muslims and that are talking about issues that facing Muslims. So I think that is why this is happening.
Peace and tranquility has returned to Sweden, but tensions remain high as both local Muslims and the Swedish authorities know that the Quran burners will be back. Paludan has made absolutely clear that he intends to run in the Swedish elections this September, and it's very likely that he will bring further unrest back with him. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
Insight. Good evening and welcome to this episode of Insight. It is 60 years now that the U.S. has imposed economic sanctions on Cuba. We will be discussing this issue and other issues related to Cuba in a conversation with Alberto González Casals, Cuba's ambassador to Iran. But first, this brief analysis.
We recently witnessed the large amount of sanctions that the US and Europe imposed on Russia following its invasion of Ukraine. We're also very familiar with the US and Western sanctions that have been imposed on Iran in the last 43 years following the Islamic Revolution that overthrew the US-backed Pahlavi dictatorship in Iran. However, many forget that this year it will be 60 years that the US has imposed an embargo and economic sanctions on Cuba following the Cuban Revolution that overthrew the US-backed Batista dictatorship in that island nation. If we look at history, we see that the conflict between Cuba and the US did not begin with the Cuban Revolution, but goes back to the beginnings of the United States and the Monroe Doctrine, which declared the Western Hemisphere to be America's sphere of influence or backyard, and that the US would not tolerate foreign powers being present in that region, declaring this mainly to European colonial states which had colonies in the Americas. This was particularly true of the island of Cuba, which was a Spanish colony located less than 100 miles from the US mainland. From the very beginning of the United States, plans for the conquest or purchase of Cuba from Spain were made in various administrations. During the time preceding the American Civil War, southern slave states made efforts to stoke war with Spain in order to annex Cuba and add it to the list of slave states at a time when new states in the American West were being added to the US territory, most of which were free, non-slave states. Finally, in 1898, the imperialist factions in the US were successful in igniting a war with Spain. Following Spain's defeat, the US formally declared Cuba to be a US protectorate, as well as receiving Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines from Spain. The United States granted Cuba the appearance of independence in 1902, but imposed a constitution on Cuba that gave power over Cuban foreign and economic affairs to the United States, and even gave the US the right to intervene militarily at its own discretion, which it did on numerous occasions, including the occupation of the famous Guantanamo Bay, in which the US maintains a naval base, and which is the notorious site of the illegal detention and torture of hundreds of people that the US has kidnapped in its so-called War on Terror since 2001. This was followed by years of the United States backing the Batista dictatorship, in which Cuba became the center of criminal activities of the American mafia, particularly money laundering, gambling, and prostitution, where the Batista regime was paid off from the profits of these criminal activities in order for the mafia to continue these activities. Following the revolution, the Cuban government, under the leadership of Fidel Castro, sided with the Soviet Union in the Cold War, leading to the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 and Cuba's active involvement in many wars of liberation and decolonization in Latin America, Africa, and Asia, further enraging US leaders. If the US excuse to impose sanctions on Cuba throughout the Cold War was Cuba's backing of the Soviet Union, the continuation of the sanctions after the collapse of the Soviet Union and its continuation until today by every US administration shows that maybe the real reason for the imposition of US sanctions has always been that US elites want to punish Cubans for their independence and to let this serve as a warning to other nations in Latin America and around the world who would want to follow this example. Despite the countless assassinations, coup d'etats, and dirty tricks that the United States conducted throughout the world, it has for 60 years miserably failed to overthrow the Cuban Revolution, and Cubans have been able to reach high levels of human development and are now among the most advanced nations in medicine and biotechnology, and among the few nations who successfully developed their own line of COVID vaccines despite these sanctions,
which deprive Cuba of its largest natural market for its products and services. Given the rapidly changing global environment and the powerful non-Western and anti-US alliances that are forming in the 21st century, it might become easier for Cuba to exist as an independent, revolutionary nation in the next 60 years, in a future where it will matter less if the US imposes or does not impose sanctions on a nation, even a nation that is located so close to the United States.
Ambassador Casals, thank you very much for joining us on Insight. As you know, the program tries to look at the issues from a historic and strategic perspective. We have taken the occasion of the 60 years of U.S. sanctions on Cuba to have a conversation with you today about the history of Cuba, about the different things that are happening there in Cuba and in the region in Latin America, but also Cuba's relations with Iran. And we would like to ask you to please share some of your insight into these matters. And before we get to the historic issues, let's start talking about the sanctions. So, as you know, Iran has been sanctioned for 43 years. We were, until very recently, the world champions of American sanctions. This honor has now been given to the Russians. They are now starting to get it. But the country that has been the most sanctioned in history is Cuba for 60 years. Some might say that it is not worth the trouble for the independence. Some countries want to be independent. They are willing to accept sanctions. Some countries, no, they don't care. They will do what the Americans say and get all the different consumer products that they think the people want. So I would like to ask you in this way. Is it worth it to suffer under the sanctions and have independence? Or is it better to do what the Americans say and have all the consumer products that you want?
Yes, of course. Thank you so much, my friend, to having me in your program. And thank you so much to Press TV, to all your teams, for this opportunity to address to the audience, to the Press TV. Regarding the sanction, as you said, of course, Cuba, we have the number one sanction from the United States. Only in the last period of this person's named Trump in the United States, they got only 244 measures against Cuba, sanctions against Cuba. They get the worst situation for Cuba and the worsening in this moment. We don't have difference now in this moment with the Biden administrations that supposed to be as another kind of administration. They will change something in Cuba or regarding Cuba or toward Cuba. But nothing changed by the moment. We said more or less that it could be in the same situation we have. And the people of Cuba are suffering, of course, and our economy is suffering in a very hard situations because of the sanctions. There is no any sector, there is no any situations regarding Cuba that is not affected by the sanctions from the United States. Not even no family, no person, even living in Cuba or living overseas, is not affected by the sanctions. All of us are affected one way to another one by the sanctions. Mainly, and the more hard and sensitive, is regarding the medicines and the sector of medicines and the health sector, of course, and affected most a lot. Personally, I have my own experience that one family of mine died because of we cannot get in the proper way one medicines from the lab from the United States. They denied, due to the law of the embargo, to facilitate these medicines to the Cuban people. And so my personal way, I need to suffer a loss from in my family. And like me, many people in Cuba, we have many situations regarding the health sector, the food sector, I mean agricultural sector, because anything is under sanctions on Cuba. Even if you import any kind of goods that have at least 10%, only 10%, building in America, this is under sanction for these situations. And as you said, but we have 60 years in these conditions, and it's getting run, and we will continue in that situation if they don't want. It's not Cuba who blocked the United States. It's not Cuba who affect the economy of the United States. It's not Cuba who make a sanction to the United States and nobody in the United States. So it's not in our size, the solutions. They need to get conscience about it and to get, this is all politics, this is obsolete politics, this is illegal politics that they toward to us. Of course, the sanction from the United States is not only because of the United States. It's because of there is some people too, or some countries that support the United States in many ways. So the United States not only can't put the sanctions because it could be almost impossible to guard in the economy, a global economy. But in the people follow the conditions from the sanctions in the United States, of course, affect to us in the same way. We will continue, of course. It's more important for us, the moral that we have in front of the world. We are a hope. We resist, and we will continue to resist. We have 60 years, we will have 60 years more. If they want to continue to do it, it's their own problem. They affected too, not only the Cuban people, they affected too the American people. They prohibit, even against your own law, prohibit the American to visit Cuba. Cuba is the only country by law in the United States that they cannot visit. Even they could visit, the American could visit any place that they could be dangerous, and pay place like war or something like that. But Cuba, only 90 miles from the coast of the United States, they cannot visit Cuba.
A lot of families.
At least legally point of view. And the point of view of the family too. They affect to the family, the Cuban family that living in the United States, and the Cuban family. They divide the families of the Cuban family there. That's, and they don't take care about that. They have emptied their embassy in Havana. We still have the relationship. We promote the normal relationship between Cuba and the government of the United States. But even they quit the consulate. The American consulate in Havana is practically not working in this moment. So the Cuban people need to go to so far like Guyana or some another place to obtain the consular topics and consular procedures to get to the United States and to get the visa. After that, staying there in Guyana, in many ways, they deny the visa for the Cuban who went there. And so the Cuban people, sometimes they get illegally entered into the United States. They promote the legal way to get migrations to the United States. They broke the talks that we have in migration topics that it affecting in this kind of way. And later than that, they condemn us because the people want to go to the United States due to the situations in Cuba. So they block us. They make a sanction to our economy. They don't allow the normal people to make the consular affair. They make a lot of things against Cuba and the Cuban people. Then they decide this is an internal problem. So it's not because of that. It's because it is the American that they consider that they are the police in the world, and they not consider to have in the proper way the normal behavior as a neighbor. We want a normal relationship with the United States, but not under conditions and with all respect to our sovereignty. And answer your question, of course, we will continue to resist until this moment.
Great. With your permission, I want to now get to Iran-Cuba relations.
Yes.
Of course, our Iran-Cuba relations became much stronger after the revolution in Iran.
Yep.
We even had, among the revolutionaries in Iran, contacts with Cuba before the revolution. Mm-hmm. So this contact goes even further back, before the establishment of the Islamic Republic. But then when it happened, of course, Cuba was one of the main countries that supported the revolution in the international fora. We had very interesting and nice things that were said at that time by the leadership of Cuba, by Fidel Castro and other leaders, in terms of advising some of the things that we might want to do at the beginning of the revolution, in terms of establishing our various revolutionary organs and organizations. And there's a lot of interesting stories about that that people who are interested might want to go look that up. We also had the state visit by President Castro.
Yes.
That very famous state visit where him and Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader, had a very interesting and long discussion and meeting. We've had recently Iranian Vice President for Economic Affairs going to the inauguration of Daniel Ortega in Managua, and that big meeting that was there, including meeting with President Díaz-Canel. They had a meeting there. We had the meeting of the foreign ministers in New York at the General Assembly in September.
Yes.
So because of our revolutionary background, because of some of the things that you mentioned in terms of having the same problems with the Americans and the sanctions, we've had very good relations. And I think maybe most interestingly, very recently, we had the co-production of the COVID vaccine, Soberana.
Yep.
Between the Finlay Institute in Cuba and Pasteur Institute in Tehran. And basically, the thing that I think is interesting for people to understand is that Iran and Cuba are actually biotech, very, very strong biotech countries that are independent from the global pharmaceutical, you know, whatever you want to call it.
That's, yes, yes.
We are able to produce our own medicines and able to give it to other countries that, that need it, that might not have this. So if you could please talk a little bit about that aspect, this very successful cooperation that we recently had for the vaccine, and then we can get to other issues regarding Iran-Cuba relations.
Yes, my friend, of course, the relationship between Cuba and Iran is so strong in a political point of view, and we try to improve that in point of view, economical point of view. We said that it's not the same level, the political relationship we have and the economical relationship. Of course, they have their own causes because of the embargoes, both country and the blockade. It's difficult sometimes. We are so far, and of course, but we are promoting the best conditions in a commercial and economical relationship. And that one that you mentioned regarding the cooperations in biotechs is one of the most good example about it regarding this this matter, no? And we are moving forward. Let me tell you something before. Many people said, or some people in the world said, I heard about it, that the relationship, the strong relationship between Cuba and Iran is due to they have the common enemy. It's not that, only that. Without the United States or not, taking account the culture, the idiosyncrasy, the stronger behavior of both country, always we will be friends. Both countries will need to be friends because we have good people, we have friendly and hospitality people on both sides, not because of we have a common enemy. That, of course, is coming in the same way. But back to the this cooperation we have in this matter of the vaccines, of course. You know that the leader, Fidel Castro, at that moment promoted that the Cuba, he said Cuba need to be people from scientists. And they promote a lot the development of the biotechs in Cuba. That's the result we have now. And of course, we are in the best position to cooperate and to share our success with our friends. First, with our friends, of course, like Iran. And talking about the embargoes and these kind of things, I always said that sometimes we need to thank these sanctions, because without the sanctions, maybe these great scientific people, like Pasteur Scientific and the Finlay Scientific, maybe could not meet if we don't have the sanction. We find in the proper way to try to cooperate in this, in both sides. I don't know if we use it at that moment without sanction, Pfizer vaccine or something. No, we are using our own vaccines. Cuba has five vaccines in this moment, and we cooperate with Iran. They have their own vaccines, and they produce their own vaccines, and we are promoting to vaccinate our people and to have in the proper way. But not only in these fields of COVID, we are cooperating in many other fields in biotechs in different ways, even the pneumococcus vaccines. That pneumococcus vaccines in all the world is expensive, even in the hands of the West country in the high level, and they sell this kind of vaccine in a very high cost for that. And we are cooperating to produce our own vaccine, I mean, Iran and Cuba, to produce our own vaccine against pneumococcus, and we will facilitate in this kind. That's the best way to do it. The President, His Excellency President Raisi, during my meeting with him, my introduce my credential to him, he told me something very real. The best way to overthrow the sanctions against our country is to cooperate each other, to stay together each other and with the unity of each other. And that's really, that's this cooperation shows this kind of success that we have. It's amazing. I am really impressed with the potential of the economy, the potential of scientists, the potential of the everything that you have, even in the economy for food and everything that you have here. And you produce on your own resource. That's the best. And that's the best conditions that you are making a lot.
Yes, I think, Mr. Ambassador, this COVID epidemic showed that, unfortunately, the world, in terms of medicine and in terms of these things, in the hands of some big corporations
yes.
that control the government, that you don't know, so many people are having so many side effects from the vaccines that were rushed in America to quickly get them out. So many people are having heart attacks and all these problems. Mm-hmm. The vaccines in Iran and Cuba, nobody has having any problems.
Yep. Yep.
So I think this is a very important thing for humanity. It's not only simply because we want, you know, our countries because medicine is not like another product. It's something that's a necessity for humanity, and some people just don't have the money for it. So I think this is very important that what you are mentioning in terms of the cooperation in terms of medicine and biotech, both countries are actually, we could say, powers when it comes to medicine and biotech. In a global situation, and coming together and doing that would be very good. So with that in mind, I want to maybe go a little deeper and ask you that if I were to ask you, what would it take for Iran to establish a strategic depth in Cuba? What would it take for Cuba to establish a strategic depth in Iran? Make Iran the place where they can manage their affairs in West Asia. Iran having a base, a friendly base in Latin America. What are the things, in your view, that we could do? I would just reference one small thing. We saw that Iran is able to really project its power to the other side of the world when it came to the issue in Venezuela, as you saw the very severe sanctions that Venezuela had and the hyperinflation. Mm-hmm. It was basically Iran who helped them save their oil industry, which was lacking because of sanctions. Mm-hmm. And also we saw consumer goods, Iran opening up very large supermarkets and stores and giving, because as you said, Iran has a very large production of consumer products.
Yes.
One of the things that people criticize, they say Cuba, yes, it's independent, it has its high tech, it has good military and security, but of course the consumer product side is... So if you could please give us your insight on the ability of these countries, two countries, to establish a strategic depth in each other's countries.
As I told you, our relationship is so strong, and we are ready, and we are in the best conditions to cooperate in many issues in different kind of way. But the main our program and strategy is to develop ourselves, and that we want from Iran, and maybe Iran want from Cuba too, is to cooperate and to develop on ourselves in this kind of matter. And the case, of course, it's really nice, and the conditions that they have in the bilateral relationship within Venezuela and Iran, and they developed the supermarket there. But we want to our own supermarket. We want that the Iran help us to create our own supermarket with our own branch and with the help of Iran, and later we could do it on ourselves. We want the Iran to support us in the energy the topics, but we want to your support, and later we want to do it in our cells in this kind of matter. That's our strategy, the point of view to develop the country, of course. We cannot depend on Iran, and it's not fair to do it. It's not fair to do it, to be in the side of Iran and waiting, because Iran have their own problems, and they have their own situations. That we want is to cooperate in knowledge and know-how, how to do it, we can cooperate, and in both sides too. We want to cooperate like this one, like the vaccines. We issue our, and we share with Iran our know-how about it between both institutes, and we share this kind of condition. And each country developed their own vaccines. I mean, Iran developed their own vaccine, and Cuba developed their own vaccines. That's what we want, and that's our politics about it.
Yeah. Okay, very good, Mr. Ambassador. So it seems to me that there's a lot of potential But there also seems to be maybe some historic problems in terms of investment that's necessary because of the sanctions. Of course, we can't use dollar. There's many different things. We can't use different banks. Cuba went through a difficult period after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Mm. They had the special period. Yes. Of course, Russia was able to help after that as well. But as you said, Cuba doesn't want to be dependent on one country.
Yes.
So in terms of the problems that you see and how to overcome them, in continuation of what you were talking about, in terms of being able to build this cooperation. So we had good examples in medicine. Is, for example, the establishment of joint companies.
Yes.
Because, you know, obviously, given Cuba's laws in terms of establishing companies, of course, there are companies that are already working with Cuba from other countries. So in that field, if you could talk about it, also given the fact that there has been a very successful economic reforms in Cuba recently, at the time of President Raul Castro when he started.
Yes.
And we see other countries, other communist countries, such as China or Vietnam, other countries that maybe China we can't compare, but Vietnam we can maybe compare.
Yes.
That were able to liberalize, if we want to use that word, they were able to open up as it related to private property, to small businesses, and with foreign investment. So if you could please give us a little bit more detail, a little bit more in terms of what effectively, practically, Iran and Cuba need to do in order to establish that strategic
We began a process for a long time ago, and even not only with the Raul Castro presidency, before even with the Fidel Castro presidency, and that we call update of the economy. many people use the liberalizing, you know, reform, and that one, I don't care about the semantic point of view, but we call update the economy and to try to promote the economy in the same way of the socialism in Cuba.
Which other countries have done as well. Which other socialist countries have done, and they were successful.
Yes. That what happened is they don't allow to us to make a lot of move forward in this kind of matter. Each time the American get something that we are getting in a proper way, they attack this point. Sometimes with success, sometimes without success. But they attack. And so they don't allow us to go in the proper way. That's what that sometimes get delayed in some change that we may making in the economy in Cuba. It's difficult to obtain in financial point of view. We don't have loans. We cannot access to loans in international kind of way. Like Iran, we don't have access to Swiss system. Despite that, like Venezuela said, okay, we are we are better out of the Swiss system, but we need to consider maybe the countries that are all out of this kind of system create our own systems.
Exactly.
Not only depends on that. Because it's
which is happening. Which is happening. China, Russia,
yes,
different countries.
They are getting in order to get better in the financial affairs. But, of course, we are promoting investment in Cuba. In this investment, of course, that we share in order to create our own systems on the economy and on our own point of view. In another hands, in mutual beneficial point of view, another country. That's important. That we want Iran invest in Cuba, in energy, that we need in energy, not only regular energy, but it could be 2-4, and it's so important, renewable energy. You have experience in this kind of matter. And we need to investment in the food sector, in the agricultural sector, and industry sector that we need. As you know, Cuba is a large country affected by the climate change. We have wonderful conditions for tourism, but we don't need only tourists. We need more than that. And even now, we are all around us is the sea, Caribbean Sea. And the sea is penetrating the land sometimes and affecting the plantations on this kind of matter because land is getting salty in this kind of situations. So we need technology in this kind of way in order to produce that better in Cuba. We have now that we call now a special zone of development in Mariel area. Mariel is the name of the area that we are creating a special zone for investment in any kind of way. We have, as you said, a nice relationship with Vietnam. That they put some industry there, China put some industry there, and Russia to put some industry, and we are expecting to Iran to put some industry in Cuba, and you are a good experience in order to do it.
Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for your time.
Our pleasure.
To be here and to allow me to address to your great audience and for that. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Ambassador Casals? We found out that Cuba's struggle for independence from the U.S. has a long history, a history preceding the 1959 revolution, and it goes back to the beginnings of the development of the nation-state system in the Americas, with the U.S. consistently showing territorial ambitions for the Spanish colony of Cuba because of its geographical proximity to the U.S. mainland. We found out that Spain was forced to transfer Cuba to the U.S. following its defeat in the Spanish-American War in the late 19th century, without in any way taking the wishes of the Cuban people into account, and that for the next half century, the U.S. practically viewed Cuba as a protectorate, intervening into all aspects of its governance at will and turning it into a center for the criminal activities of American organized crime. We found out that despite the severe embargo and sanctions imposed by the U.S. following the Cuban Revolution, Cubans were able to achieve a relatively high level of social development for the general public, particularly in the fields of medicine and biotechnology, where Cuba is a global leader and one of the few countries in the world that was able to develop and manufacture its own line of COVID vaccines. We found out that Cuba, like many other developing countries, is in need of investment in the industrial field, and that U.S. sanctions also affect this area, discouraging some investors who might otherwise be willing to invest. We are witnessing the formation of new non-Western global alliances in the 21st century that could allow Cuba to continue on its independent and revolutionary path in an easier fashion than it did in the 20th century, and lessening the pressure it experiences from its imperialist neighbor to the north, who now maintains the sanctions only because of the corrupt U.S. domestic political system, where special interests can hijack foreign policy and hold it hostage to the narrow interests of wealthy lobbies. Thank you for joining us. Until the next time on Insight.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.